Welcome to another episode of the Magnus and Marcus Show on Coaching. Joined as always by John Marcus. John, good to have you back.
It's great to be back. They thought they'd get rid of us, but we're back, baby. Cross-country season be damned.
That's right. Late nights, who cares? Just get one of these talks in.
Yeah, for sure.
Which is, for those who are loyal listeners, we thank you, and we apologize for being away for a couple weeks. It's just been, the start of cross-country season for both of us, which is crazy. So today we're going to talk about, a little bit of psychology, which is, kind of our pet field, I'd probably say. And we're going to talk about a subject that you sent me a nice little podcast about and that I'd read before called the Dunning-Kruger effect. Okay. So since you sent it, I'm going to let you start off and explain what that is, and then I'll add my two cents in.
All right. Well, yeah, a friend of mine actually sent me the link to the podcast, and I, off the You're Not So Smart podcast, I believe, series, gave it a listen, and, we heard it's one of its lead, contributors to it, Professor Dunning, give his little talk about what that was. I think they won a Nobel Prize for it. So all very, very high level things here. But essentially, boiled down, it's, nothing new that hasn't been already discussed through philosophy through the ages or, any kind of religious tradition. I mean, essentially, those who know don't speak, or those who speak don't know. Or, if you get it, no explanation is necessary. But if you don't get it, no explanation will suffice type deal, which basically, as they put it, those who are incompetent at something think they have a high degree of competency at that activity versus those who are a little bit more educated and less competent are more globally aware of their vast incompetence. So it's kind of this, double-edged sword, catch-22 type theory.
Yeah, and the way I look at it is it's almost like the more you know, the less sure of yourself you are, right? It's like the disease of learning. When you don't know anything, when you're ignorant, you think you're a genius because anything new is like, oh, that makes sense. That's great. And when you delve further and further into the depths of all these things, you start questioning. It's not as clear. You realize that once clear thing is now this muddied forest of never ending trails that can take you any one direction. So it's interesting. And I also think you see this tying it into running. From the athlete standpoint, you see this all the time in that a lot of times the younger athlete, the more inexperienced athlete, we'll say the one who's not hooked up into running, has way more confidence than your more abled athlete who might be a better athlete but is overwhelmed by his knowledge of everyone else in the race, of how running works, of all those good things. And it's probably one of the biggest issues we deal with psychologically.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, I actually have a case study that proves that to a T. Even, no pun intended, but T. Roy Brown, who I've talked about several times on this pod, who I coached while I was at Florida State University the last couple of years, he fits that perfectly. His first year ever running track and field, he goes out in his first 2,000-meter race ever, and just goes and wins the race because that's what that guy did. I go on, I win things, and it ended up being a school record for the university. And then the next year, he had that awareness about, oh, I know this guy and his PR in my field. I know this guy and his PR. Oh, I know what now good is, quote unquote. And so now I'm more cognizant of these splits. And okay, I got to move here. Oh, that guy's pretty good, and he's surging. What do I do now? And totally took him out of the race. And so the following year, even though he had showed more fitness and more development in terms of training, he goes into the race a year, wiser supposedly, but comes out of it 6-8 seconds slower, just because he was more concerned about trivialities, about PRs or numbers or guys' names, than actually just focusing in on their basics of running to win.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. When I was in grad school, actually, in training with Alan Webb and then our other good friend Moses Joseph. The first race I think me and Moses ever went to together, and I was trying to make, you know, chit chat conversation on our drive down to it. And I was like, oh yeah, who's in the field? Like, what do you think about these people? And Mo turns to me and is like, it's like, Steve, like, I don't know who's in the field. I don't want to know who's in the field. Like, I don't look at any of that stuff. And I was like, you know, at this point, Mo had been to the Olympics and world champs and stuff like that. And I was like, really? He's like, yeah, no. He's like, even at the world champs, like when I get my heat for the 800, it's like, I don't look. It's not because I'm scared of anybody, but it's because like, I just want to do what I need to do and not worry about all these other things and not overanalyze it and not like let that affect what I can do. And that was the first time I saw it from an athlete standpoint of like, oh, like that makes a lot of sense, because at that point in my life, I was definitely an overanalyzer on things.
Yeah. I think that's what plagues every competitive and, you know, thirsty athlete is they have a cycle where they go through this overanalyzation of everything. It's like you start off, you're new, you have some success, you're PRing, it's great. And then you want to learn more about your craft. You want to learn more about your art, your discipline. And so you start to really, you know, fine tune and collect all this data, you know, about other people. What are other people's training methods? What are this? What are that? What are these people doing? And now there's a proliferation of that data available via all the, you know, media and personal media outlets here. And then it sometimes clouds and it distracts you from doing what got you good in the first place, which is doing you. We actually just had this with Tara Ergman, you know, last couple races here this summer. You know, after a little bit of layoff, she goes and runs Falmouth, and, you know, okay, talking about who's in the field, okay, move with them, do this, do that. It all proved to be, you know, useless because she was so overanalyzing who was doing what and just went and had a bad race, you know. What she said, it's just a bad race because she wasn't running her race. And then a couple of weeks later, she goes around to US 20K champs, and we're like, don't worry about anyone but you. Wear a watch, run your pace, and if there's people around you, great. If there's no one around you, great. Just grind and just do you. And she had a much better result and a much better process because, you know, we washed away all the dirtiness that, you know, worrying about other people can do to an athlete, and empowered her again, just focus on her strength and run her race. And I think sometimes as a coach, you know, I know I have to be careful not to over-inform the athlete about all the things or all the competitors or all these different nuances about an upcoming race and know that athlete really well and just be able to give them the bare facts and sometimes tell them to turn off their brain and just say, just go do what got you here. And, you know, it's that fine balance, right? You know, you have to be really aware of what your strengths are as a competitor and as a racer, because you only can do one or the other. You only can either, you know, think or you can, you know, react. You can't think, process, and then react, because by the time you do that, the reaction you needed or wanted has already, that opportune moment, season has left. So I always tell athletes, it's one or the other. You're either thinking about your splits, or you're thinking about this, or you're thinking, or you're reacting, responding, and racing. I mean, my philosophy is I'm the coach. I'm the one who's supposed to think. You're the one who's supposed to just react. If I, you know, give you some encouragement, or we have a race plan, or this just happened, and you instinctively feel you have to do X, Y, Z, stay competitive, then just go with that gut reaction, because 9 times out of 10, that's the right reaction versus waiting 200 meters, waiting a mile, figuring it out. Should I move? Shouldn't I move? Da, da, da.
Yeah, exactly. No, I always say it's our job as a coach to take all those complex ideas and then make them as simple as possible. And we deal with all the back end stuff, and the athlete just needs to deal with the reactive stuff. Like, it's almost like you want it so ingrained, you want it to be, the athlete to just be intuitive thinking. Like, it's just whatever pops in, they do. Right? But I gotta ask, so tying this to our Dunning-Kruger effect, like, how do you, in your opinion, how do you maintain that balance, right? Because you want almost athletes who are naive, right, enough to think that they can do crazy stuff. Because what happens a lot of times, and I'll get to the finish this question, sorry. What happens a lot of times is that, like, as people grow in their understanding of the sport or the understanding of whatever it is, right, any subject at all, as they start putting limits on themselves because they have expectations of what everyone around them does. So how do you create that naivete, which allows people to have almost no set limits or expectations, but still develop and foster, like, that knowledge and growth and, like, love of sport or subject that comes along with, like, being hooked up and being like, oh my God, I want to consume everything running, right?
Right. So
how do you think you do that?
Well, I think you have to be clear about what your intentions are and why you're practicing this craft. And for me, right, for us, dude, like, we operate in the high performance realm, you know, college and post-leisure running. So it's about being competitive. And there are certain things we need to be able to do for these athletes to be competitive. Now, what I like to do, like, in workouts when someone's progressing or getting better and getting fitter is have them not wear their watch and look at their watch during the workout. Let the watch record but not direct. So often the watch directs, and there's this emotional component to what arbitrary time is put on an arbitrary distance in a session, whether that's good, bad, or indifferent. And so if an athlete's, you know, coming, like today's a good example, you know, just in practice today, we had one of my 1500 meter post-leisure gal, Janet Connor, who, you know, 414 PR is her name from last year. And she's doing mile and a half repeats at kind of a threshold-ish type effort, so like 540 on the track, and then some 800s, you know, at 80 to 78, four of those after the 2x1.5 miles. And the last 800, I'm like, just run at a controlled, but yet, you know, challenging rhythm. And she's been running like 79, 78, was looking at the watch, staying on pace, and then the last one, you know, 10, towards the end of the session, she's most fatigued, runs, you know, 75, 72, or 227, you know.
Yeah.
And that was just, I was like, what do you think that was? Afterwards, she was, I don't know, like 237, you know, a 10-second gap between what she felt it was, what she thought it was, the value judgment she put on the effort versus the reality of it. You know, and that's, sometimes we have to do that as a coach. You just have to let the athlete just run more by feel, and then you record it and then show them what the record of that feel was. And so then that allows the athlete then to recalibrate their level of confidence, their level of, okay, whoa, I'm at a whole new fitness bracket. I mean, it's a very good teaching moment. And the thing I like most about, you know, second parting of this answer with cross-country season is cross-country affords that opportunity, too, to stay more in the moment. It's like, just beat people. I mean, we have a new guy in our post-leisure group who just came over from the UK, and he's like, what the hell is this cross-country PR business you guys talk about in the States? There's no cross-country PRs in the UK. That's, you know, it's hogwash or whatever, you know. He's like, cross-country PRs? You know, just like appalled. And we don't have, you know, they don't have those over there, but yeah, we do. We're like, oh, man, they ran this fast on this race, or they ran this, you know. Like for high school, Woodbridge is like this fast course, or, you know, in college, there's all these different courses you might have in your region that are fast, and all might have this kind of PR. Last time I checked, right, you go into cross country, especially like at the, you know, any NCAA national championship level, it doesn't matter what your track PR is. It just matters, you know, are you bringing that toughness on the day? And it's just about beating people. So my race strategy for a lot of athletes I work with, you know, on the scholastic side for cross country is, find some other team that has capable athletes and let's beat that team. So let's have our one beat their one, our two go after their two, and just run to win. Just run to win your race within the race. And, you know, it might be someone who's quote-unquote faster than you on the track, but how many times at the NCAA level do we see an NCAA cross? Oh, this guy's a 13:35 K runner, and he gets like 200th at NCAA cross, right? It's because that that PR on the track, that one time trial race on the track, doesn't equate to necessarily being able to race and game up at a high level, you know, every time. So that's how I kind of do it. I try to say, let's be more in the moment and think about what we're doing, which is competing and trying to compete at a certain level, prepare to compete at that level, and then just trust we've done that, rather than getting all wrapped up and putting, you know, value judgments on these arbitrary times for these arbitrary distances.
Yeah,
what
you know.
Yourself, Steve?
So I actually love your answer with the watch, and I'm going to tell you why. Well, not surprisingly, and we don't discuss this stuff, but I do the same thing, right? And that, like, that having them run something and then asking the question of, oh, what do you think that was? That is a brilliant teaching moment, right? And it's also a brilliant coaching, like, informative session. Because what you get out of that is you get the degree of mismatch, right, on that day. And if you do that enough, a lot of times what you see is you have people who are almost like overestimators, or they're the opposite. They're underestimators. Or if they flip, then you know they're either really tired or really feeling good, right? So it's one of the best things we do. I mean, I do that all the time on our long runs when I'm running next to someone. I'll be like, oh, what do you think that mile was? Or on our intervals, they'll go run something. I'll be like, oh, what do you think you finished at? Before telling them. And then, as you said, it's that recalibration. I mean, we had a fantastic example last week. I did out on the cross-country course at the Texas A&M invite, which we were at the day before. I did a tempo run going 4 miles, then a 3-minute break, and then 3 miles with one of our post-collegiate girls, Hillary Montgomery. And she's run like 16:05 or something like that on the track last year in college. And so we were doing this tempo, and I was running next to her, and I was like, oh, I'll time it, I'll measure, like, I'll take the splits, you just run. And, you know, the first mile, she's like, are we under 6-minute pace? And we're clicking off like 5:25 miles. Like, she ended up averaging 5:25, 5:28, somewhere in that. And her first instinct is like, are we under 6-minute pace? Right?
Yeah.
And that was probably her best tempo ever at that time. And I didn't tell her splits until, you know, we were through the first 4 miles. But it was like, it's like that degree of mismatch gives you information. And if I said like, hey, like, we're too fast, or like, you just went out at, you know, 5:20 mile pace, like, you're going to blow up. Like, that gets something in their head that isn't supposed to be there, right? So
is the coach placing the limitation then on the athlete, saying, oh, too fast, you're going to blow it up, you know, it's like...
Exactly.
That's also dangerous as well, too.
Oh, it is. It's because you're putting limits on it. And this is, again, not to go into coaching 101, but, like, what I did in that situation was, like, I look at my watch, I'm like, dang, we just came through the mile in, like, 5:25, like... She's never done a tempo run this fast, especially since she has 4 and then 3 more. Like, that's 7 miles worth of work. That's pretty quick on a cross country course. So my reaction wasn't to be like, oh, let's slow down. It was to be like, okay, like, she went through this. She obviously thinks she's feeling okay. Let me test. Like, let me ask her some questions to get her to talk, and let me listen to her breathing when she is talking, and let me look at her stride and see, like, okay, like, she's all right. And that's what we did. I mean, she was talking. So I was like, she's fine. Like, let's keep going at this, even though it's faster than what my expectation going in was. So I think that's a good point, is like, as a coach, like, you set the tone. You can't limit your athlete's expectations based on, you know, telling them, oh, too fast, slow down. Like, this might be the time when they're ready to roll and they're clicking it off and it's going to be a breakthrough.
Right. Yeah, I mean, 9 times out of 10, my expectation as a coach, the arbitrary split I give people to run a session in, is going to be wrong. And I tell people that all the time. I've gotten more to the place where I'm giving them a range where I'm like, okay, let's run quarters between 70 to 73 type effort. And let's just kind of feel it out. you know. And then it's then the other question is, the other question that's really important too that I always ask is, how challenging was that? You know, and we go on like a, you know, some athletes, a percent effort, you know, 0 to 100%, you know, or 1 to 10 or whatever, but just how challenging was that? And people say, oh, it wasn't that challenging. And then I say, well, okay, how fast you think you ran? Okay, you ran this. Great. And then you can kind of see what their correlation is too. Or if they say, oh man, that was really hard, that was really challenging, and they think they ran really slow, but they, you know, end up lighting out for them. I mean, that too gives you another kind of psychological opportunity to learn more about, okay, how they correlate their perceived effort with what time they need to run. Because now also the tricky thing is you coach an athlete and they get more fit and they get capable of running faster. What used to be fast to them in their mind, like tempoing at 6 minute pace, which was like, oh, that was the hardest thing. I just remember so hard several years ago, you know, and now they're running 5:25 pace and it feels like that 6 minute pace effort that they just had in their head that's hard to tempo at 6 minute pace. They have to understand like their calibration has to shift as well. Like, oh, I am fitter now and I'm more capable. So now I can do this. And how do we know that you can do this? Cause you just did it. You know? Like you can do this now. But I think sometimes we get too wrapped up as coaches. And, you know, I know I used to do this on this progression, this nice periodization progression of time. Your threshold time should come down. Your VO2 max time should get faster. You know, and it should go like every week you should get quicker. Or every 2 weeks, that's just how it's supposed to be. That's how the body adapts. You know, I think this is where you get back to the Dunning-Kruger effect, is the more you know, the more you know that that's not the case. Like periodization or like adaptation is a very inconsistent, very, you know, kind of like starts in the dark type thing. And we're hoping it fits this model. We're hoping it's nice and linear. We're hoping, you know, when you step back and look at it, but it's very peaks and valleys. And I remember telling someone the other day too, like the more I talk to peers and the more I, you know, go out and learn and listen to podcasts or conferences, the more I realize we just have no idea actually how people get better, but we just do. We just know they get better if you just put a good amount of work on them and you give them some time to recover and absorb it. I can't pinpoint exactly what hurts or what makes you better, but something out of everything we did works. It's kind of like that thing where it's like, I forget which CEO said it or which famous person said it. I know marketing works, but I know 50% of marketing works, but I don't know what 50% works. You know, and it's the exact same thing with coaching. Like whether you value high mileage or you value steady states or you value getting into the gym and lifting or you value technical drills and getting shin angles just right. You know, some of that stuff is likely to have more of an impact than others. But as you get older too, as an athlete, like what got you here isn't always going to get you there, wherever that next there is. And I see this so many times with athletes. It's like they've had this miraculous season or a series of years, and then they kind of go through a doldrums and some coaching changes, or they get older, or they, you know, go from the college level to the post-collegiate national class level or high school to the college level, and that competition gets a lot stiffer, and all of a sudden they're just not as good, or they're hurt, or they aren't running, and they're not competitive anymore. Like, oh my God, what am I going to do? Okay, I'll just go back to what once worked for me, because that's what worked for me 4 years ago. And it's like, well, yeah, that was 4 years ago. And the competition was a lot different than what you're competing at now. And just to go back to that because you know that's what worked then doesn't necessarily mean it's going to work now, because the rules, as you and I know, Steve, adaptation aren't hard and fast. They're kind of, hey, we see some correlations and we see some kind of consistencies here, but this is our best shot at this right now. And when a new study or new coach comes out with a whole new paradigm or a whole new philosophy or system, and a whole new like pace chart, then everyone's going to shift to that. You know, I mean, it's just like people ask me all the time, what pace chart are you? It's Millen, Daniels, this or that. I go, I'm aware of what there are and they're good loose guides, but more times out of time, defer to the athlete. And, you know, and I think that's to get, you know, to kind of piggyback on a old podcast rant I went on about being a lazy coach. That's what a good coach does. A good coach defers to how the athlete's feeling on that day and defers to the feedback of the athlete. Oh, you did this one session. Great. Now if Hillary can like sustain that for another couple of sessions, right? They'll be like, okay, yeah, she's really at this new fitness bump. She really is there where 525, 530 is comfortable threshold rhythm. But she might have had one great workout and it was like everything came together. And then all of a sudden she's, you know, so many different factors, right? I don't know what is helping or hindering. And I had the same conversation with an athlete who like strained a hamstring a couple of days ago. You know, he was wise enough just to be like, well, we did some general strength med ball work the day before. You know, he was sitting a lot. He was like, yeah, you know, I'm not even to say it was just that, you know, med ball session we did that was making my hamstring tight. There's all these other factors going on. I go, yeah, they all probably had a little bit of a contribution to it. Yep, volume and intensity. Last couple of weeks, you're sitting down more because you're in class now and studying more. You know, now we're doing this med ball work where you're jumping more. Like, you know, all of it had an impact on why your hand is a little tight now, but at least you're mature enough to know it's not one thing. And I think sometimes we're looking for that one scapegoat, that one thing of, this is the one thing that makes me fit. Or this is the one thing that got me hurt, so I'm not going to do it anymore. And that's where the Diane Kruger comes into effect. It's like, you just have to know that we just really don't know. Like, we're just educated guessing coaching at the end of the day here.
So, way to crush the myth that we actually know what we're doing.
Sorry, guys. Sorry.
But it's so true, right? And it's Dunning-Kruger, right? As you the more you know, the more you realize you don't know, right? But there's actually a brilliant quote and. By David Foster Wallace, right? The writer.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Who said, the more you think you're really great, the bigger the fear of being a fraud is. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And it's like that. I mean, I can relate to that completely because it's like the more people think you know you, the more people think you have it figured out, the more in your head you realize like, no, like, we're educated guessing here. Like, I know all this stuff, but no, adaptation is crazily weird and complex. People don't realize it doesn't work like in the little textbook. There's, you know, four or five different theories on how adapting to a single stress works, and they're all over the place, right? It's like us as coaches, like we're not mind readers. We're not like some experts who can figure this out and make an exact science of it. It's educated guessing. And what good coaches have is they get 80% of it right, and then the 20% wrong, they don't get. Well, it cancels itself out, right? It doesn't matter. Yeah. But no one is doing everything 100% right. And I think that's a brilliant, brilliant point and something that I think a lot of times we forget, right?
Yeah. Well, it's like I have athletes asking, like, oh, what's your system? What's your training system? I go, my system? There's no system. Like, it's not like I don't know what I'm doing. I'm making up as I go along. I mean, the system is a system of adaptation. It's like, at what rate can you adapt? What rate can each athlete adapt? It's, you know, a buddy of mine called it mass customization. It's like you're customizing for the masses within your team or within the athletes you have to work with. It's like, you know, I know what principles I hold of high value. Like I hold of high value running, time on the feet. I hold of high value threshold training in a general prep cycle. I hold of high value lifting to get like kind of a neuromuscular and endocrine response. Those are all things that I've seen work and has worked when I was an athlete and all the silly things I did to try to test out when I was still running hard. But as I talk to more and more coaches and peers and colleagues, they might be like, John, dude, you're working them way too hard in this cycle. Like, or why are you hitting them, you know, boom, 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 like this? Like, you know, do a little bit less. Or, hey, maybe incorporate a little bit more neuromuscular specific turnover here when they're fresh rather than do it towards the end of a session when they're a little bit more fatigued. Like, what are you trying? You know, so I always have that conversation with mentor or colleagues where I'll invite them out, you know, to come watch a session or talk about a session an athlete has. And then they'll be like, well, why? Why'd you do that? Or I'll ask them, well, why are you doing that? I mean, I've had those dialogues with my Kiki, Lex Excellence coach, where she'll tell me, okay, here's what Lex is doing. We'll do that. I'm like, oh, yeah, what do you think? I'm like, here's what I think. Why are you doing that? He goes, oh, well, I'll go on. And then I'll tell him, like, what some of the pull squeezes I'm doing right now are doing, like, it's a fall and internal phase. And go, oh, that's a lot of volume. Don't you think? You know, and I'll be like, well, Mike, that's a lot of intensity. Don't you? You know, and we'll just go back and forth. And we might not change our views, but at least, you know, we know it works. I mean, so, and that's the hard part. It, like, it works because these athletes are getting better. They're PRing. They're competitive for them. And it's like they're not getting hurt. So it's like you can't say why it works just as long as you know it works. Now, if your athlete's getting burnt out, they're getting exhausted, they're getting hurt, they're pulling muscles in practice, you know, how much of it, one, is your fault as a coach? Two, how much is it their fault as an athlete for not taking responsibility to do all the restorative practices they need to do in their own self-care protocol?
Exactly.
I mean,
I think that's a great point, and tying this all together a little bit, as I attempt to do and most of the time fail. But I think that's the best way to prevent this, like either overestimation or underestimation of your own expertise or your own knowledge, right? Is to make sure you're engaging with others around you, with other mentors, mentees, whatever, to keep you giving perspective, right? It's if you can have these debates and these back and forth, what happens is, like, it helps you refine your own viewpoints. It exposes you to new things, and most importantly, makes you think. And I think if coaches can do that without having an ego about it, because a lot of times it's like, oh, this is my system and this is brilliant and it works.
Right.
If you can step back and realize there's a billion ways to do it, then I think that's where you can kind of transcend some of these issues with our biases towards our own knowledge and experience. Another thing on that topic is I had a really good mentor once tell me that when you get good at something, or when you get really knowledgeable about something, you're going to tend to be biased towards reading things that back
affirm,
that up.
Yeah.
Yes, that mm-hmm. affirm.
Yeah, yeah.
And you
need, it's a confirmation bias.
Exactly. And you always need to read stuff that in that first page where you think this is horrible or this is not, mm-hmm. I would not do that. Because it forces you to see the other side, and it also forces you to explain in your head, all right, why do I think this is bad? Why is that my viewpoint? So, just some tips.
Yeah, I think, you know, Steve always tries to relate my rants. That's something. I feel like that's what we should call it. John rants and Steve tries to relate the original topic podcast. you know, I mean, getting back to it, it's like you just got to keep learning, you know. And I think a true craftsman, whether it's like Zero Dreams of Sushi, that's another great documentary that's out there that I really recommend everyone like take 90 minutes to watch. A true craftsman is never satisfied with perfection. Like there's no perfection. There's always, you can get a little bit better. You can ink out a little bit more mastery. You can ink out a little bit. I think that's what we have to do with coaching is, at the longer you're coaching, the more you're challenged to evolve as a coach. And I think, too, it sometimes behooves coaches to step outside a certain silo. Like, that's why I really am passionate about working with classic athletes and high-level national and world-class, you know, aspiring post-collegiate athletes. Because if I just lived my life in that, you know, elite world, and all I focused on elite times, it's like, you know, I wouldn't have the opportunity to really hone my coaching to see, okay, well, it's, you know, I go from one practice in the morning where I have women running 5:30 mile, you know, type effort for threshold or, you know, what have you. And then the next, in the afternoon, I go to the classic kids with these freshman girls who are running into running, and it's like, all right, ladies, we're going to do mile repeats at 7:15 pace. You know, I mean, it's humbling the pace, but it's still the same thing. It's still coaching, it's still trying to get these people better. And I think sometimes we put that, you know, label on us as a coach that, well, I coach people at this level, so I'm this type of coach. And I think you just want to coach people who want to be excellent. And that's really the distinction I made. High performance is a high degree of commitment to excellence. And it doesn't matter what level that's at, you know. And those are things that I know right now. And again, as per the Dan Kruger effect, maybe my scope is really small. And the more I know, that view will change here in 2, 3, 4, 5 years. But I think that's the impetus of the Dunning-Kruger effect, you know, calls upon, is to just understand that your scope is narrower than you think it is. and you have that humility, that's how you can actually become better, because you can learn things from anybody versus saying, well, I'm only going to learn from, you know, the most elite coaches or people who coach people faster than I currently do.
Exactly.
Which is not the case at all.
No, exactly. I think that's where, you know, we've both been fortunate to coach at pretty much every level, and it gives you that appreciation that coaching is coaching. And I wouldn't have figured out some of the things I have without coaching at the high school level, right? And working with athletes who aren't supremely talented. So I think to call this to close, because we're almost at 40 minutes, to call this to close, I think the overarching theme is, like, be humble about your coaching, be able to step back and see the bigger picture, and then I think also is, like, have ways to self-assess, whether that's giving athletes the opportunities to self-assess and kind of correct that mismatch between their expected maybe pace or effort and their actual, or if it's from a coaching perspective of, like, self-assessing your own system and having peers or colleagues or even asking or even discussions with athletes on where you are as a program and what you're trying to do, and always kind of redefining your own kind of norm and coaching and correcting those mismatches.
Exactly. I mean, it's kind of the thing we always say, never stop learning. You know, you do that, you're always going to get better. And you always go into a conference or you go into somewhere with the auspice that you're the least intelligent, least knowledgeable person in the room, you're going to learn a hell of a lot than going into a room full of colleagues or peers and saying, well, I've coached so-and-so at this level, champions, blah, 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 I know it all. It's like, you know, that's kind of the death of a coach. When I start hearing someone say that, I'm like, ooh, when do you stop evolving as a coach? Because I hope, you know, I can look back at my coaching methods and philosophies and workouts this year, 2 years, 3 years, 20 years from now, I'd be like, ooh, why did I do that? I can't believe those people got better. Jeez, what'd I do?
Exactly.
You know, I know too much more now. So, I mean, you know, always keep evolving.
Exactly. No,
that's all I got.
So that's a great way to end. I'll add, because I think this is a valuable lesson for younger coaches, is that no one has the answers. No one actually knows exactly what they're doing. If they tell you they know what they're doing and can guarantee success, then I'd actually be cautious, right?
So, yes. Oh, without a doubt.
We all walk around thinking we're frauds. Like, that's it. I can sit here and tell you, you know, me and John have coached at every level, but we walk around thinking, like, when are people going to think, like, oh, my God, or when are they going to pull the curtain back and think, oh, my God, these guys don't actually know what they're doing? Because no one does.
Yes, like,
no,
why are you
does.
Listening to this podcast? We don't know what we're doing. Why are you listening to us? We don't know. I'm just kidding. But stop listening now. I'm telling you.
All right. So now that we've told you all to stop listening, we'll just call the episode there and see if anybody ever listens to us ever again.
Hopefully.
Sweet, John. Well, this has been a fun one, and thanks for people who stuck through this wild and random rant. So we'll try and get back onto a regular schedule with our cross country seasons underway. They might be a little hectic, or might be calls after cross country meets. We'll try and make it work.
Awesome. Thanks everybody for listening. Hopefully it wasn't your last time listening, but if it was, all the best on the road.